And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Brian Krim, as we're talking about his work, Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. And this hour, as we continue talking with Brian, we'll take your phone calls as well. Fascinating subject. Welcome back. Brian Krim with us, of course, Dr. Brian Krim, and we will take your phone calls as we talk about Project Paperclip as well. Did you encounter with your work, Brian, any references to UFOs or other classified documents that would be of interest to us?
In fact, I did, and I wasn't expecting to necessarily. Most of my research is coming from a what's called the interagency working group that worked throughout the Bush administration to declassify millions of documents related to Nazi war crimes and Imperial Japanese war crimes and the U.S. knowledge of it. So I got what I discovered came from this recent release of documents, and so I even pulled it, at least my notes on it, because they would not let me photocopy it when I was at the National Archives in College Park. But I found this very telling document that was dated October 28th, 1947, which, is, as you know, is just a few months after the Roswell incident.
That's right, July.
In July. And so I'll read directly from it, but basically it's a memo from the headquarters of the 970th Counterintelligence Corps Detachment, European Command, and it just says flying saucers, air intelligence guide for alleged flying saucer type aircraft. So I'll read what I have here. Quote, an alleged flying saucer type aircraft or subject in flight approximating the shape of a disc has been reported by many observers from widely scattered places such as the United States, Alaska, Canada, Hungary, the island of Guam, etc. The object has been reported by many competent observers. Sightings have been made from the ground as well as from the air. The German High Command indicated a definite interest in this Horton type of flying wing, and were about to embark on a rigorous campaign to develop such aircraft toward the end of the war. And the remainder of the document is urging all intelligence agencies to find out which Germans could have produced this flying wing and flying saucer, and it is assuming that the Roswell craft, as well as others, are Soviet aircraft that the Germans likely built for them.
Uh-huh.
And it's which kind of plays into what a lot of the early documents relating to the flying saucer.
And the occupants that they reportedly said were ETs could have been just little people.
Yes, or maybe they even suggested that it may not even be have people on it at all, that it could have been remote, which would have been really advanced. But it seemed to, they're worried about this Horton wing, which, you know, was something that we actually brought a whole flying wing to Wright Field, and they're thinking that this was the culprit in all of these sightings, or at least many of them. But the fact that there's a whole what we call a Kriegsleit type of intelligence burst saying, you know, this is a high priority, and they're calling it flying saucers, means that there's this marriage of what may be myth and reality here, that there's definitely awareness of this, but they don't know what it is, but they're assuming that it's Soviet.
And that's an interesting twist. Help. Interesting twist, because the Germans clearly had that Horton wing as a testing piece of equipment, didn't they?
Yes, they and like so many of these early this breakthrough technology, there's prototypes, but they're never in a position to mass produce it to have any effect on the war. We brought one prototype over, but our imaginations are left to run wild if you're an intelligence agent at the time to say, well, what else do they have that could be in the hands of a foreign power? And that must be what we're looking at. That must be the cause of these unique sightings. At least that's, you know, that makes them feel better, at least, to think that.
All right, let's take some calls here for you. We'll start with Carol in Las Vegas, west of the Rockies. Hi, Carol.
Hi, George. Hey, in 1968, I met one of those scientists. My dad had a big gold dredge, and we put it in on the North Fork of the Yuba River. And there were like four or five families that would come together every summer. And this one family came in, and they had an older man and woman with them. And they spoke kind of broken English. But we understood that he was special and he was the grandfather and, you know, dug him out gold and, you know, he had a wonderful time. But the father of this family grouped us all together, being stupid kids, and telling us, you don't breathe word in town, you've met this man. And we're all going, huh? And he says, because there are people that would like to hurt my grandfather. They would like to take him back. So, you know, after he's gone, then you can tell anybody you've met him. But
huh.
Interesting.
Yeah. So,
go ahead, please.
So that was, you know, he was carried a bullet behind his knee. Hmm. And he was a very interesting gentleman.
I guess he's no longer with us.
No, this was in 1968, and I would say he was in his late 70s, 80s.
Oh,
then.
Definitely not, unless German technology has kept him alive, huh?
I doubt. But, you know, I perked my ears up, and I said, I met one of those men, and my grandparents were German. So my father still spoke enough that he could converse with the man.
Did they love this country, Brian? Thank you, by the way, Don. Did they love this country?
Well, you know, for the most part, they absolutely did. The ones that could not adjust, and there are quite a few. I mean, we tend to I think that once they came here, they stayed. Well, a lot of them served out their contracts. Initially, they might have 6 months, and they might be a few years. But West Germany was a prosperous country by the 1950s as well, the economic miracle, and many of them chose to return. Others didn't have a choice because they were either too controversial or they had troubles that made them unpopular with the press, some of the more high-profile ones, and they were asked to go back to Germany. But the ones that stayed, especially around Huntsville, Alabama, and Wrightfield, Ohio, and there are communities all over the country, which is why it's not surprising that you would have listeners that would have come across them, they not only stayed, but they are examples of chain migration. They would bring their whole families with them. And they became American citizens happily and easily. So, yes, they did love the country, but the ones that did not left and within at least 4 or 5 years. So they were self-selecting.
Next up, we go to Tim in Wisconsin. Hey, welcome to the show, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Just wanted to say some kind words to you. I'm a former radio pro myself, and I know what it's like to get ambushed with sudden news while you're doing a broadcast, and I just wanted to comment and say that you really handled everything excellently last week with Art's passing, and I just wanted to commend you for being just a stand-up guy and just a great radio pro, George. You just unbelievable how you handled that situation. I just can't imagine what was going through your head at that time, and I just wanted to commend you for that, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead with a question for Brian. Well, we've got you.
Yes, absolutely, George. Brian, I wanted to know what your thoughts are looking back on World War II. What do you think, you know, whether it's, you know, Goebbels and his, you know, propaganda machine or Himmler and his, you know, death cult ideology and Hitler's ideology, how much of that do you think has influenced, you know, world affairs today? And when we look at what we're seeing globally right now with conflict and a lot of dissent and a lot of fake news and propaganda, can you speak to how you think possibly, you know, Germans during that era have continued to influence us today?
You know, it's a really good and profound question. It's one I struggle with in the classroom when I have students who are, of course, have no memory, and not even their parents might have a memory of being, you know, instructed about the nature of the war. But I think what has survived is the apparatus, the mechanism of spreading what we might call fake news or propaganda. That it has become a dark art to, and no one was a better practitioner of this than Goebbels. The power of the image, the power of rhetoric, the skill of cinema to create almost a hyper reality. I think that those years of not even during the war, but before the war, kind of the complete control.
Oh, he knew marketing. He was a genius when it came to that.
Absolutely. And I think that survives, and not just the ideology, which of course does. And we see it taking on a new form in a place like Russia now, where it's ethnic based, it's a racial worldview, but it's now supported by the power of a type of media that even Goebbels could never dream of. But I think that playbook is what survives and what terrifies me, not so much, you know, Nazi ideology in particular, but the ability to spread a toxic ideology with now just an apparatus that is so entrenched, and I worry about that.
Can you imagine, though, Brian? I mean, they had everyone, when you would meet each other, Heil Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, they had, geez, can you imagine that?
And the pace of how things change. You know, we live in this news cycle, and of this, everything is so fast that we become numb to it. And I think that's very much how I had to be a quote unquote ordinary German in the 1930s. Is that how do you even keep up with the pace of change? And of course, now it's a faster pace.
What do you think of the Holocaust deniers? I mean, you've looked at the Holocaust, of course.
Yes, and they're also aided by this, you know, explosion of information technology, and that I think that's why they still endure. I've noticed that in the Holocaust denial is no longer denial of the event so much as relativization or minimization. They can't deny the event anymore. There's just too much. But what they can say is it wasn't as bad. Or it's kind of like people who talk about slavery. Well, it wasn't as bad as you think.
It wasn't 6 million Jewish people, for example.
To say it was typhus instead of yes, it's a battle that we fight as educators every day. I'm glad to see. I don't think it is taking root in young people and students especially. I think there's a hyper awareness in some ways, but it's certainly something that came up in the Paperclip Project as well. You have a lot of these scientists are involved in the crimes of the Holocaust, and the U.S. government in some ways is aiding them in their denial, because to have them be tarred in that way would undermine the project. So it's a kind of an ugly story all around. But this new generation is dangerous because of, once again, the technology at their fingertips.
When Wernher von Braun came here, how quickly did he basically go up the ladder?
He was rather frustrated for the first, you know, 5 years.
So I'm almost regretting coming here.
No, but he never got that far. But he used to say things like, "Well, when I was at Penamunda, they gave me everything I wanted. What's wrong with you at the U.S. Army?" He was the most entitled person you could imagine for someone who was lucky to be, you know, alive after considering how many people were after him. But I have this great quote I wanted to share with you, where he said, shortly after being captured, he said, "We felt no moral scruples about the possible future use of our brainchild. We were interested solely in exploring space. It was a question with us of how the golden cow could be milked most successfully." And that was his logic for saying, well, if the Russians are going to pay me, I'll go to them. If you're going to pay me, I'll go to you. I just want to get the space. That was his passion. And he felt that the U.S. Army was short-sighted in the first few years he was in America, because they didn't know what to do with him either. Because we were learning from him, not the other way around. But once he was transplanted in Huntsville at the Redstone Arsenal, mm-hmm. and you have a whole Army agency that he essentially directs, well, then he dictated affairs, and was really the only thing that kept him from being the head of NASA was Eisenhower. He said, I'm damn well not going to let this German war criminal. He did not like von Braun.
Wow.
To be rector of NASA. So it had to be a civilian post.
Well, Eisenhower was there, you know, so yeah. Those feelings ran deep. Donna in Huntsville, Alabama. Speaking of Huntsville, welcome to the show. Hi, Donna.
Hi, I'm a misplaced person. I'm not originally from here.
Okay.
It's just a fluke that I'm here. I'm one of the daughters of one of the original American engineers that worked with Wernher von Braun.
All right.
Are you familiar? I'm really interested in what you're saying tonight, because there's a tremendous amount of accuracy from word of history. Are you familiar with the first group in the United States to work with Wernher von Braun? Do you know who they were?
The Americans? No, not specifically, other than a few of the General Electric employees.
Who were they, Donna?
It was my dad and his group. It was from the
And what kind of group was it? What did they do?
Franklin Institute Research Center in Philadelphia. My dad was a electrical engineer and an inventor, and he had a group of men there. They were doing a lot of work.
Were they working on rocketry or anything like that?
Not at that particular time, they didn't, but the government came up because nobody else would touch them with a 10-foot pole, and they asked my dad if he and his group would work with Warner Von Braun. My dad said, sure.
Did he like him?
Oh, yeah, they were good friends.
Hey, I heard he was a nice guy.
Yeah, he was nice. He and my dad were good friends. I have film and photos and all kinds of stuff. I wanted to ask your guest, are you familiar, Brian, with who came up with the theory of induction?
Induction?
Induction, no.
Hmm?
Was it your dad?
Yes.
I knew it. How did I know that?
I'm leading you that way, Mr. Norrie.
Your dad was a genius, Donna, to be sure. Great minds, great science and everything else. When you were writing the book, Our Germans, and doing the research, what did you come across, Brian, that surprised you the most?
Well, I think it was the not so much the opposition to paperclip within the bureaucracy, but how the national security state that we're used to thinking almost as a monolith was deeply conflicted and at war with one another. The level of vitriol between those that were adamant supporters of paperclip and those that opposed it, not so much on moral grounds, but also just practical grounds, was truly enlightening and made me think about, some of our current divisions between, say, like the State Department versus the military. I always expected some level of pushback against the idea of bringing, unvetted, honestly, or poorly vetted, or purposely poorly vetted Nazi scientists to America, to have that kind of opposition, but the nature of it was so brutal. It was deeply rooted in anti-Semitism, it has to be said. There were some Jewish officials of the State Department who were attacked personally for daring to even suggest that maybe we should investigate these people a little better. The way Congress will interfere, the McCarthy era actually is deeply related to paperclip because they used that as a weapon to attack anyone who they felt was not patriotic enough to say, why didn't you let more scientists in? And it was something that shook me that this was going on inside of our own government during these crucial years of the early Cold War, that we were at war with each other over what has to be said is a relatively small project, an enormously important one, but the numbers of people involved were relatively small. So I was surprised by the level of opposition and the hostility, the deeply personal nature of the hostility between the pro and con camp.
Were the German scientists that ended up in the Soviet Union, did they feel as if they lost? They had the bad draw?
No, it's a good question. They were released, forcibly sort of released from their employment in the early 1950s. There was a moment in the Soviet Union shortly after Stalin's death where the ideologues came back into power
got rid of them, huh?
We got it. They released them, and they went to West Germany, they went to East Germany, they came to America after the FBI.
Wow.
Made sure they
all
were.
Of them?
Not a lot of them did, but they were also not trusted the same way as the ones we already had because they had been in the Soviet Union. For
right. You would think that they were Russian spies or something like that. Brian, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Brian Grimm with us. His work, Our Germans, Project Paperclip of the National Security State. His website, again, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Brian, did Wernher von Braun, did he have to sell the space agency on prolonged space involvement, going to the moon, and that whole plan?
He did. He was an Army employee. He knew that that's why they brought him here primarily, and he was very skilled at implying that whatever is accomplished with a military breakthrough is also going to help with space travel. And so He never, and that's how he operated in the Third Reich as well. He knew that he had to build the V2 as a weapon in order to get to a point where it would be seen as a worthy invention in and of itself. So he had a lot of practice when, you know, selling the military uses of technology. And he wrote a science fiction book called The Mars Project, where he envisioned a space station that would blow up the Soviet Union by dropping atomic bombs on it.
Oh,
he really had a flair for selling space and with culture and being what we might call a public scientist. I have a picture up on your website with he's very cozy with Walt Disney, and you probably know he was a featured player in the Man in Space series that ran on television, a very, very popular show. So he also edited a very famous film to sell Hitler on the idea of the V2, knowing that Hitler was someone who loved movies and that type of imagery. So he's always been a salesman and a very effective one by always implying that space is linked to military superiority. And that would work in the Third Reich as much as it would work for the U.S. Army Ballistic Missile Agency in Huntsville.
Died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 65, way too early.
Truly, yes. It was. It's hard to believe how young he was when he came to the country. He was in his 30s. So this is.
We were talking before the break, Brian, on in your research, if you stumbled across anything that just was so fascinating for you. And let's get into that again.
Yes. I mean, as far as Paperclip overall, one of the things that I had not really known was how the contingency plans for a possible invasion of Europe by the Soviet Union involved a massive operation to essentially slash and burn all of Europe's leading technological centers and remaining German scientists and swoop them up in some, you know, grand operation. Remember, 1950 was such a frightening year for the Cold War, especially with the invasion of South Korea by the North, which everyone assumed was the prelude to the real invasion in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I came across a meeting between the National Security Council and some agencies that dealt with Paperclip over the long term, where they had planned really to just take everything that wasn't nailed down of value in Europe before this invasion could occur. And it was, yes, a contingency plan, but it was so well thought out. It just proves the point we mentioned earlier about how fast, how evolved the national security state had become since the beginning of World War II to this moment, where it could even envision it and have the transportation laid out, and to think in those terms was a real eye-opening discovery.
Let's go to Larry in Virginia on the wild card line. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I just wondered, having encountered a lot of Germans in my military careers and being trained by native Germans in California, I met one guy who was a retired aeronautics engineer and, you know, taught us German as, you know, something to do in retirement. And I wondered, being stationed in Augsburg for 7 years, how much we got from Messerschmitt with the 262 and those aeronautics guys.
Yeah, it's a good question. It was one of the it was certainly on our radar from the beginning to get to the Messerschmitt factory and definitely to acquire prototype working ME-262s, which wasn't a problem to do. And so one of the first shipments to the United States were ME-262s. The British were pretty advanced with jet engine technology already. We were farther behind. So once again, this was an issue where we were able to catch up by turning a blueprint into an actual workable product. And that ME-262 was instrumental in that. But there was a sideshow to Paperclip was something called Operation Lusty, which is a great name, but it really stood for Luftwaffe Secret Technology. And that the 262 was the top of the list of things that they wanted. And yes, it was definitely a major find and one that was we'd already experienced firsthand in the air. I mean, this is one a case where they did have more than just a prototype. They were doing real damage to the bomber fleets.
Yeah, the primary mission of these scientists while they were in Germany was to build up the war machine. Do you think they protested? Did any of them ever talk about this after the fact when they came here? I would guess they probably said, you know, we were so opposed to this, but we had to. They were forcing us to do this.
You know, you would think that would be a likely response when they're pressed on that. But normally what shown through and was this idea that I called technocratic innocence, that the scientists don't have to ask, is it right or is it wrong? And that's how the German scientists would talk to their interrogators, which is, we're scientists. We are given a problem and we solve it. To us today, that sounds amoral and a kind of a dangerous worldview. But it was something that the American interrogators also encouraged them to believe as well, that it's not your fault. We need you because you're problem solvers. That was your problem then. How do you build a guided missile to attack London? Now you can do that for us. So they weren't even required to pretend to even be appalled by what they did, because the United States national security state wasn't asking them to think in moral terms either. We assumed that they were technocrats first, and that's what we wanted. But it is true that when they were being interviewed for immigration and they had to go through security process, they all really kind of coordinated their answers to say, well, we were forced to do this, but we're also fighting the Soviet enemy, and that's who you're fighting now as well, so aren't we just in it together? So it was a very – I think it was a disturbing thing for me to encounter just how – amoral we were,
right,
and how we approached their question of guilt or innocence or even regret.
Carlos in Carson, California now. Hi, Carlos. Go ahead.
Good evening, George and Brian.
Hi.
I've got a question for Brian. You know, historically, our government has been secretly sending technology to our enemies and technicians, like we did with Soviet Russia. Westinghouse and General Electric were sending technicians to prop up their industry over there. We did the same with the Germans. Now, I read an account whereby we ourselves sent the blueprints and the materials to the Russians to build the atomic bomb. They went through the account that I read. It went to Gore Air Force Base through a Major Jensen that was involved in that. But what worries me more, due to the history of we aiding and abetting our enemies to keep the war games going on behalf of Illuminati, I'm afraid that some of this technology that we've been historically sending to these countries like Russia, China, has gone over to Kim Jong-un in North Korea. You know, what do you think about that?
If I think technology transfer is so much more prevalent now, because it is, as I think we can all agree, that the military-industrial complex has outgrown national boundaries of all kinds. So it's not so much that a government is supplying technology to one nation or another, but companies, which are limitless in their ability to operate, it seems, don't serve a particular national master anymore, despite some of the laws trying to prevent that. I think the real danger is that technology transfer is so unregulated that it is very easy to have hostile forces acquire some of the most advanced weaponry simply because of a profit motive. And this is something, of course, that Eisenhower warned in 1961, you know, his famous address, that this is the prospect of having the scientific technological elite with too much power means they're not going to use it with any sort of moral authority, and certainly not under any national allegiance even.
We've got Phil now in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program, Philip. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Brian, how are you?
Great.
I worked with an engineer who came over here in the 50s. And I wonder if this name rings a bell. His name was Otto von Lossnitzer.
It does ring a bell. Yes.
Hard to forget that name if you knew who was here, huh?
Yeah.
What did he do, Phil?
Well, first of all, when he came over here, he worked at Springfield Arsenal for a while until they closed. And then a company called Emron Corporation hired him, and he was our chief of research and development at the time. We were an ordnance manufacturer, and we were working on the 30-millimeter project for the A-10 Warthog and making them out of aluminum cases. And I worked in the ballistics range out here, and I met him, and I probably was one of the few people that really took an interest. And I, every chance I got, I had an opportunity to talk with Otto, and I learned a whole mess of things from him. He was a grand old gentleman. There's a book by that's printed by Mowbray Press on him, and it details all of the patents that he had because he was a chief of research and development at Mauser in Germany, at Necker, Oberndorf in Germany during the war.
You know, it's interesting. I could tell this to all your listeners. If you do think you have a you've encountered one of these scientists, if you go to the National Archives College Park site, they have what's called the Foreign Scientist Case Files, and there are 1,500 names there. And if you are very specific, you can even request a copy be made of that personnel file. But there are, it's an amazing list. That's part of this release that was done at the end of the Bush administration.
Were there any scientists who fled to South America and just didn't want to go to the United States or the Soviet Union?
There were plenty. In fact, the United States helped many of these scientists get to South America because if they were too, what was one of the phrases I heard, if they're too hot for us, meaning that they had real major criminal records, they were in the SS, they had convicted of war crimes, that yet we still wanted to take advantage of what they knew, we would make sure they found a home in Argentina or Brazil. In fact, Alan Dulles himself made sure that one epidemiologist named Walter Schreiber was able to take himself and his family to Argentina under what the Perón regime so that we could still use his knowledge without having to deal with immigration and the inevitable press fallout.
Helen,
it happens quite a lot.
Let's go to Helen in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Helen. Helen? Nope, she's gone. Let's go to Ed in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Get you in real fast. Go ahead, Ed. Well, he's gone. Let's go to, there's Ed. He's over here.
Yeah, I'm over here. You still there, George?
Yep, there you are, Eddie.
Hey, George, I just wanted to mention, and Brian, I guess the guest name, Operation Paperclip. I've always been an aeronautical enthusiast all my life, and I know you mentioned briefly about Operation Lusty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they went in with hundreds of freighters right after World War II, and they just loaded the ships with every advanced aircraft that they could get their hands on. But Henkel Aircraft Company had the first flying 282 twin jet engine fighter. And they were in a political battle between Messerschmitt and Henkel. Mm-hmm. So Messerschmitt won the contract, so Henkel's contract was killed. And that would have been 1937, the first operational German jet fighter. And actually, the first jet fighter flew in 1935, which was a Henkel 187. But anyhow, it shows these documentaries with these freighters just lined up, Operation Lusty, of all these V-2 rockets that they confiscated, and they went in and grabbed every piece of military hardware of any significance whatsoever that they could and just loaded the ships with them and brought a lot of that stuff back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where they tested a lot of it, you know, to get all the data they could out of their jet engine technology and what have you. And it's just amazing the amount of information they gathered up. But here's the thing that bothers me about all of it. Now, I love history, and especially World War II and World War I history. But you notice we have been inundated with German and Nazism for the last 40 years. You cannot, any day of the week, turn the TV on, the cable TV somewhere, and find a show talking about Nazis, the rise of the Nazi regime in Germany, and Adolf Hitler rise to power, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there thinking, what, are they in love with the Nazi movement? Are they telegraphing a message to the people of the world that this is what's in your future?
they had a lot of film footage, and I think that's what generates so many of these documentaries, is just how visual it is. And I think you're right, there's a danger in fetishizing it at times, and I have that concern as a teacher with my students, is that they're also sort of fascinated in an unhealthy way sometimes.
All right, Brian, thank you for being on the program. The name of the book is Our Germans, and we're going to be back to talk about the occult in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.